Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and as a native New Yorker, I completely understand how Lou Reed feels about this city. Here's the Rock and Roll Hall of Famer in the 1995 movie Blue in the Face.
I actually feel pretty comfortable in New York. I get scared like in Sweden. You know, it's kind of empty, they're all drunk, everything works. You go to the medicine cabinet and open it up and there'll be a little poster saying, in case of suicide, call. You turn on the TV, there's an ear operation. These things scare me. New York, no.
But even Lou Reed has wrestled with the question of whether he might actually want to leave New York.
I don't know very many people who live in New York who don't also say, but I'm leaving. And I've been thinking of leaving for 35 years now. I'm almost ready.
Yeah, famous last words. 18 years later, Lou Reed is still here. But not everyone who comes to New York stays in New York. And not everyone who stays in New York loves New York. And some of the people who do leave New York still love it. This is all very confusing to me. Fortunately, Sari Botten is here to sort it all out. She's a writer and the editor of a new anthology about artists and their complicated relationship with New York. Later, we'll hear from one of New York's native sons, Daryl McDaniels. You know him as DMC from the great hip-hop group Run DMC. And some musicians who've come to New York temporarily from Austin, Texas, for this week's annual CMJ Festival, White Denim will play live. So, look, this happens all the time. People, tons of artists, writers, musicians, whatever, they come to New York, they leave New York, sometimes they come back to New York. Sari Botten's collection of essays is called Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. Sari, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the book sort of takes its name from an old Joan Didion essay.
Correct.
So that was your starting point?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the whole book is inspired by that essay, which I relate to and aspire to. It's such a great piece of work.
Well, it seems like, you know, looking at this book, that there are many people for whom this thing is an inspiration, either in one direction or in another, you know, sort of agreeing with Joan Didion's original concept, which, describe the, sum up her original essay for us, if you would.
The way that I sum it up for people as quickly as I can is to say that it's Joan Didion writes about arriving in New York at 20, starry-eyed, and leaving New York at 28, bleary-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people relate to that.
Now, was it a somewhat taboo topic when Joan Didion first broached it, and is it still today?
I don't know about... I think it was probably sort of new at the time for somebody to sort of say, wow, New York, maybe not that great. And now there are people who are upset with the book, upset with me. You know, I see on Twitter people saying things like, this goodbye to New York trend is terrible. You know, it's not true. New York is still great. And that's not what the book is about.
Right.
The book is really more a bunch of love letters to New York City than anything.
Some written from within the city and some written from afar.
Exactly. I've got several contributors who either moved back or never left, and I've even got one who never moved here.
So now your story, you did come to New York around age 20, 22?
I first came to the city at 22, then left, and then came back at 26 and was here until 2005. I would have been 40.
Mm-hmm. So what brought you here the first time?
You know, what brings everybody here, you know, wanting to make it as whatever you are. And for me, it was a writer. So I wanted to make it as a writer.
But there seems to be a certain kind of attraction to artists.
Absolutely.
You know, writers, musicians, visual artists, you know, New York has long been this magnet. I mean, it's a magnet, as you say, for many people. But there's a particular pull, it seems, for creative people.
Well, you know, it's the world's greatest cultural center.
So then why leave?
Well, while it is the world's greatest cultural center and probably always will be, it's becoming more of a place to come once you've already made it, because it's just gotten exponentially more expensive and more difficult for, you know, artists who are struggling to live here.
Well, you know, the timing of the book, Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York, the timing is impeccable, because this has become a theme in the mayoral race, you know.
Yes.
The economic inequality, the cost of living being a major issue. And there's this David Byrne op-ed piece, which I'm sure you've read.
Yes.
Either in The Guardian in the UK or at the website Creative Time here, where he writes almost exactly what you just said. David Byrne writes, there is no room for fresh creative types. Middle-class people can barely afford to live here anymore, so forget about emerging artists, musicians, actors, dancers, etc. Bit by bit, the resources that keep the city vibrant are being eliminated. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And he's not the first musician of his era to say that. A couple of years ago, Patti Smith was quoted, I think in a conversation with Jonathan Lethem, I'm not entirely sure, but she said, you know, she advised young creative people to look elsewhere. And I think one of the places she recommended was Poughkeepsie, which is just across the river from me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so about 2 hours north of Manhattan.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Sari Botten, the editor of the new anthology, Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. It's not just writers. James Murphy, LCD Sound System. Do you know this song?
Not only do I know it, I tried to make a book trailer with it, could not get the rights.
Well, here, listen to a little bit of the song now. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down, from LCD Sound System.
New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. New York, you're safer, and you're wasting my time. Our records all show you were filthy but fine. But they shuttered your stores when you opened the door. The cops who were bored once they'd run out of crime. New York, you're perfect, oh please don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect, I mean all disrespect, in the neighborhood bars I'd once dreamt I would drink. New York, I love you, but you're freaking me out.
James Murphy and LCD Sound System, from their album Sound of Silver, which came out in 2007. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. Sari Botten is editor of the new anthology, Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. So this is a 2007 record. You left town for good just around that time, right?
Well, I don't want to say that I left for good. Uh-huh. As I say in my introduction, if I win the lottery, the first thing I do is buy an apartment here. So,
And you still, you tell us in your story that you still keep a Metro card in your wallet.
I certainly do. I'll show you if you want me to prove it.
I believe you.
I left in 2005.
Why?
We got kicked out of an amazing loft on 8th and B that we had been paying very little money for, and the building got landmarked. And long story short, I mean, the next tenant was Michel Gondry, and the tenant after that was Matt Dillon. So
you were priced out.
Way priced out.
Yeah. Listeners, what do you think? Have you ever wrestled with the idea of leaving New York? Why did you stay, or why did you go? You can post a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or leave your story on our listener line, which is 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. We're talking specifically about, you know, writers, artists loving and possibly leaving New York. But, you know, it's something that many people in all walks of life have to deal with. Your compilation, Sari, is 28 writers. They're all women, as it turns out. Was that the intent?
Not originally. I hate to say this, but, you know, I'm very grateful that Seal published the book. I loved working with them, but I had wanted to publish a co-ed anthology, and I had some really great men lined up to contribute. But I had to go behind my agent's back to get to do this. Every agent I've ever had has said, no, you're not doing an anthology. It's too much work. Nobody can make any money off of it. And so I went behind her back and, you know, I don't know how to go out and get a book deal. And so I went here and there, and ultimately I found a publisher that publishes books by women for women. And I love the book, and I feel really grateful. But if I had my druthers, yeah. Co-ed.
So do you think women have a different experience of New York City from men?
I do think women do have a little bit of a different experience. You know, women have a different experience of everything, and also just, you know, climbing any kind of ladder, it's more difficult for women. We make less money than men. And also women have to decide earlier. Mm-hmm. Than men, whether they're going to have a family. Yeah. And having a family in New York City is hard.
So what has the reaction to the book been so far?
Mostly it's been really, really positive.
Oh, that's too bad.
It's well exceeded my expectations. The book has been flying off of shelves and been really ranked very high on Amazon. I mean, it's just been incredible. But there are also some people who are just... not happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, does this mean that where I live is no good? Does this mean that everybody's leaving New York? And it's a collection of essays about the concept of leaving New York. It's not 28 anti-New York screeds.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, a manifesto about how one should leave New York. It's a book about this thing that I think everybody thinks about.
Yeah. What about, is there a danger of kind of romanticizing the good old, bad old days of New York when, you know, as Deborah Harry of Blondie once put it on our show, when real estate was garbage and garbage was everywhere? a line I will never forget.
There is that. And I think every generation, you know, looks back, you know, at a different level of garbage. And but I also think, though, that there's been such a rapid escalation of, you know, real estate prices and the cost of living that I think it's different. It's not just that I'm, you know, romanticizing grit. I could afford to live here. I could afford to have an apartment by myself.
Right.
I can't do that now. There's no returning for me unless I win the lottery.
Well, one of your contributors, Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild, the hiking memoir, talks about, you know, coming from Minnesota, living in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, in Park Slope, on 7th Avenue, she writes, at a time when you actually could still live on 7th Avenue in Park Slope. And she's, you know, she's talking about like 1992. You know, which was not, I mean, by 92, things were beginning to, you know, they were no longer the crack-addled 80s or the rat-infested 70s, you know. Things had begun, at least, to cycle through. So, I don't know. I mean, it seems like, you know, as you say, every generation has something that they're looking back at.
Yeah, it's perpetual, you know. And also, I mean, I remember in 92 when I was living in the East Village, people still had to... when they were inviting you to Brooklyn, they had to say, it's really nice and it's safe. Right. You should come.
Right.
I remember people saying that all the time when they would have a party. No, it's safe to come to Brooklyn.
Well, let me go back to this David Byrne op-ed piece in The Guardian. He writes, I don't believe that crime, danger, and poverty make for good art. That's BS. But I also don't believe that the drop in crime means the city has to be more exclusively for those who have money. Does it seem like those two things, the drop in crime and the unaffordability factor, have sort of gone hand in hand?
It does seem like they've gone hand in hand. And, you know, the only thing I wish about his essay was that he would offer some kind of a solution. There's, you know, he admittedly is, you know, rich,
mm-hmm.
probably 1% himself.
Which he says, basically,
yeah,
in the piece.
Yeah, he admits that. But, you know, so what do we do about it?
I think what he's doing, I mean, he's not an urban planner or a politician. I think he's simply sort of his role here,
lamenting.
I think, is town crier, you know?
Okay.
There's a barbarian at the gates, and he's incredibly well-dressed and has fistfuls of, you know, hedge fund dollars and stuff. I think he's more sounding an alarm than saying, here's the problem, and this is how we fix it.
Right.
Which, you know, who is
I guess. Okay, I'm sorry, David. I apologize.
Well, you know, and I may be wrong. Maybe he, you know, maybe he does think that he has the answer. It didn't strike me as that kind of an essay.
Oh, I really appreciated his essay, and I just wonder what can be done. You know, I'd love for there to be a solution. And he talks about how, you know, the top tier doesn't pay taxes, and how do we get them to pay taxes?
Right,
you know,
and about how they do support some arts, but they tend to be the higher echelon, you know, high visibility, high profile institutions, and not the struggling, you know, the emerging galleries and, you know, the poets, etc. We're speaking with Sari Botten, editor of this new anthology called Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. And again, I will hasten to say they don't all leave New York. Some leave, some come back. One or two never left. One never even came. That is Roxane Gay, right?
Correct.
Now, you came twice, you left, it's, you know, you're still doing this little dance in the orbit around New York City, you got the MetroCard in your wallet. What do you do for art and culture in upstate New York?
Oh, there's a lot of art and culture in upstate New York. I mean, there's a lot of artists and musicians who left the city. Our number one export is probably not apples or maple syrup, but indie recordings.
And is the digital age a factor? I mean, can you be 2 hours outside of New York, and because you can Skype into your friends, or, you know, watch the same, you know, online performances as people in the East Village, you know, does it sort of mediate the distance?
Yes. A lot of people telecommute. My brother-in-law works for HP from home. That's a very easy thing to do. It's funny, when I first moved up there, I didn't want editors to know that I had moved, and I would call them from my 646 cell phone. And I live next door to the firehouse, and so invariably I'd be on the phone, and all of a sudden this thing would go off.
Well, you know, near the end, to come back to David Byrne's article, again, it's just kismet that this book is out around the same time. He ends his essay by saying, but where will I go? Talking about, you know, if it gets to the point where he feels like New York has lost its edge, its creative edge, and he needs to leave. He says, where will I go? Join the expat hipsters upstate in Hudson? Now, there are a lot of expat artists in upstate New York. Some of them, I know for a fact, have been there for decades. You know, I'm thinking of like the early tape pioneering composer Pauline Oliveros, who has lived in Kingston.
Yes, she does.
Has lived there for at least 30 years, maybe more. So this is not an entirely new sort of migration, it seems.
No, it's not. Todd Rundgren lives on Minkalo Road I guess, Bearsville. There's the Bearsville Theater, which is another great place to go hear music.
Which is near Woodstock.
Yep, just outside Woodstock, and they've got the Bearsville Recording Studio. Not only does everybody have a home set up, Pro Tools, but there's also some, you know, major recording studios there, and people have been there for a long time, and a lot of them, I think, probably also have places in the city.
Yeah.
The bigger names.
So, Sari, once you hit that lottery, first thing is buy a place back here in town?
Absolutely.
All right. You got to buy a ticket first, though. Sari Botten is the editor of the new anthology, Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. Sari, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
Should I stay or should I go now? All right, all you New Yorkers, past, present, and future, we want you to weigh in. Do you think about leaving New York? Have you done it already? You can post a comment on our webpage at soundcheck.org, or you can leave your story on our listener line, 866-939-1612, and we might use it on an upcoming show. That's 866-939-1612. Now, we've been talking about getting out of town, but this week lots of people are coming into town here in New York for the annual CMJ Music Marathon. One of the 1,400 music acts playing at CMJ this year is the Austin, Texas band White Denim. We'll talk with them later in the show, but for now, let's hear them perform something from their upcoming album, Corsicana Lemonade. This is White Denim and a song called Come Back, live on Soundcheck. That's White Denim. The song's called Come Back, live here in the Soundcheck studio. We'll hear more from White Denim later in the show, get to talk to them a bit as well. But up next, we're going old school. I'll talk with one of the pioneers of rap music, Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Daryl DMC McDaniels is best known for being one-third of the legendary hip-hop trio Run DMC, famous for marrying rap and rock on tracks like Walk This Way and It's Tricky. But these days, DMC is also marrying his passion for rap with his longtime love of comics. His new graphic novel imprint is called Daryl Makes Comics. Get it, DMC? Daryl DMC McDaniels is here with me in the Soundcheck studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, man. This is cool.
So did you always want to be a superhero? Did you always, think of rappers as kind of larger than life, bigger than life characters anyway.
Yeah, well, when I was a little kid, before I was blessed and touched by the culture of hip hop, for me growing up, it was school and comic books. And me and my brother, we collected a lot of the Marvel series. And, you know, even as a young kid watching TV, it was Batman and Superman was always on. So I definitely was one of those kids that would put my blanket on my neck with a safety pin. And I'm running around the house, I'm Batman and I'm Superman. So before I picked up the microphone, it was always comic books for me. I didn't believe I was a superhero, but I went to Catholic school all my life. And I think what was good about comics was that, you know, whether it was bullying or those issues that was terrifying to a little kid, comic books empowered me. Comic books gave me confidence, and comic books was a world where I could get away from all the trouble of being a young kid trying to survive in this universe.
Right. And a young kid with a blanket taped around his neck.
Yeah, running through the house, and my mother was always, stop jumping.
Uh-huh. So when you did finally pick up the microphone, did the comics do that for you? Did they give you the push, the confidence, the...
Yes.
The self-awareness, the self-esteem you needed
to do
that?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you listen to all my lyrics,
yeah.
Crash through walls, come through floors, bust through ceilings and knock down doors. I'm the devastator, my controller DMC, and can't nobody mess around with me. So I wasn't the kid that, you know, Run, he was like, we're going to be famous, and we're going to do this, and we're going to be selling records, and we're going to be the best group ever. To me, it was all make-believe, but... When Run had the confidence to put me in a group, I was nervous. So I would always go, okay, what would Spider-Man do right now? What would the Hulk do? So if you listen to all my lyrics throughout my whole career, they always was like, yo, DMC was always booming and attacking. That confidence came from comic books.
Now we crash through walls, come through floors, bust through ceilings, knock down doors. And when we're on the tape, we're fresh out the box. You can hear our sound. Four blocks and blocks. Four every living person. We're a verbal tree. It's me and DMC. Jay, where's the beat? DMC, I rock and roll. DJ Run, I rock and roll. It's not a trick or treat, and it's not an April Fool. It's all brand new, never ever old school.
King of Rock from Run DMC. DMC is Daryl McDaniels, who's here with us on Soundcheck today, and who's comic is a graphic novel imprint. You're launching in January with a graphic novel.
Yes.
And then the comic book series will start after that.
Right after that, yeah.
Before we go any further, something really remarkable happened when you were doing those lyrics for us in the studio just a moment ago.
Uh-huh.
You have a form of dysphonia, right?
Yes, yes.
Now, Linda Thompson, the English folk singer, also has dysphonia, and it silenced her for years.
Really?
For like a decade, she made no records, could not sing.
Hold up, Linda Thompson?
Yes.
Really?
Has dysphonia.
I have both examples of it.
Like, so there's two different species or forms?
It's abductor and adductor.
So it's two separate sets of muscles.
Right. So some people have abductor, AB.
Right.
Some have AD. I go into the – drama never ends in life. I go in there. You have both types of dysphonia.
So people may notice a certain kind of breathy quality
to
your
speaking. Yeah, when I'm speaking, right.
But as soon as you launched into, you know – crash through walls and stuff. It was as if you were.
Well,
it's 30
it's
years
funny.
Ago.
When
you know?
I've read the symptoms, when I did my own research, the symptoms are reduced when you're laughing or singing. So if you're happy, if you're happy, the world will hear you. Yeah, you know, basically. But it's weird.
You just
it's
made our engineers weird. Very unhappy
oh,
with
I'm
that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
So you were able to, you know, get into the studio, get out on stage.
Right. It's just a problem when I'm talking. And it's kind of like a superhero thing for me.
Wow.
I have a physical weakness, but I have this other super ability. Even as a kid, people told me that the people that's working with me on a comic book told me, D, whether you know it or not, you actually are a superhero. People used to tell me, yo, Run DMC and Jay, you know, rappers, all the MCs was, yo, we're like our superheroes. The funny thing is Chris Rock said this about 10 years ago in Rolling Stone magazine. They asked all the celebrities what was cool about Run DMC. You know, what they like about Run DMC and all that. Chris Rock said, you know, yo, the whole group was cool. Run DMC and Jay were cool. But DMC is always my favorite because he was like our superhero or something. The way he looks, the way he sounds. And I was like, wow. Yeah. And think about it. Superheroes always have two identities. You know, they have glasses. Mm-hmm. I wore glasses. My first publicist, Bill Adler, he used to say it was amazing to sit around DMC in the dressing room and see this mild-mannered Catholic school kid. I went to Catholic school my whole life. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying? I was a straight-A student. He said it was crazy to see this humble, mild-mannered Catholic school kid transform into the mighty king of rock. And I was like, I never thought it like that. But everything always was parallel to superhero stuff.
What do you think about, you know, the rap, the hip-hop that you're hearing today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I could never critique another person's creativity. Some of it is good. Mm-hmm. Some of it, you know, Talib Kweli, Mos Def, Lupe Fiasco, mm-hmm. Andre 3000. But 99% of it is totally what we created hip-hop to get rid of. And what I mean by that is the negativity that exists in our communities, gangbanging, drug dealing, violence, disrespect women, we created this form of communication so that we can empower and educate ourselves. You don't got to be in a gang. You don't have to disrespect women. You don't got to sell drugs. A lot of the hip-hop right now is empowering negativity. Yeah. And Ice-T told me this. He said sex and violence sells, but we know because of our generation, but positivity sells too. The same way you get put $1 million behind to promote the gangster rapper, put $1 million behind to promote the positive rappers. You'll see the same results because the kids want to know.
Well, you mentioned Talib Kweli and Mos Def. I mean, these guys yes. are still going strong, and they've had long. It's getting on 20 years now.
Right, and their beats and rhymes are better than all the negative rhyme guys. If you listen to the difference, there's, you know, they asked Ice Cube. Remember, Ice Cube was with N.W.A.
Right.
That was no joke.
The you most know, gangsta
ends
of
with
the
attitude,
gangsters.
Right, like, yeah. The top of the line thing. But Ice Cube was able to leave N.W.A., come to New York City, hook up with the Bomb Squad, who was producing Public Enemy, and he put out America's Most Wanted. Ice Cube was responsible. And what I mean by that was, yes, he was N.W.A., but then he did America's Most Wanted to explain the conditions he was talking yeah. about on it. The only thing missing from hip-hop now is responsibility. If you make a record about a gun, which you could, this isn't about freedom of speech and censorship. You can talk about all the guns you want, but when it comes to hip-hop, on that very same album or even on that same record, you have to talk about not using a gun. If you talk about a bitch and hoe, excuse me, you have to talk about, man, my Aunt Millie worked 50 years at getting on the bus at 5 in the morning, coming home 6 at night. She saved up enough money to send all her daughter kids to college. People don't talk about the good stories. I tell people this. They say, what was so special about Run DMC? We made positivity gangster. Wycliffe said DMC is the only MC that can rap about chicken and collard greens, Christmas and Hollis, and St. John's University and make it powerful.
I'm DMC, it's a place to be. I go to St. John's University. And since kindergarten, I applied the knowledge. And at the 12th grade, I went straight to college. I'm light skinned from Hollis, Queens. And I love eating Franks and pork and beef. I dress to kill. I love the style. I'm an MC, you know who's worth your while. Say I got good credit in the regard. Got my name, not numbers, I'm a credit card. I go uptown, come back home with food. Eat myself with my microphone. All my rhymes, I speak the light. So here's another one for y'all to bite.
We are speaking with DMC, Daryl McDaniels, from the legendary hip-hop group Run DMC. Along with Joseph Simmons, Russell Simmons' brother,
yes.
who was Run, and Jason Mizell. How did he say his last? Was it Mizell?
Mizell.
It was Mizell.
Yeah.
Who was, of course, the late Jam Master Jay.
Yeah.
You've mentioned, like, you know, not disrespecting women. In fact, one mm-hmm. of your most recent tracks is mm-hmm. with a woman. It's with
yes.
the noted actress from the NCIS series,
right.
Paulie P. As
yeah, Paulie P. and
Paulie
a place Paulie Perrette.
So There's something even more recent in the works, coming out in just like a week or two, right?
Yeah, it's a song that I did with a metal group.
Uh-huh.
It's called Noise Revolution.
With Wayne Static from
Static X. Wayne
Static
from Static. People was like, how in the world? I mean, I guess I'm known for crazy collaborations. Yeah. You know, we did Walk This Way with Aerosmith. I'm here with Paulie Perrette. Now I'm in the studio with Wayne Static. But what we did this record for is basically talking about taking the arts out of all the schools, getting rid of all the art programs. Jam Master Jay used to say, man, the reason why I went to school every day and did well is because I wanted to play the drums. So he knew if he kept his grades up, he could stay in the band, he could stay in that class. And he said there was a lot of kids who wasn't really gifted academically, but when you tell them you could do music, you could do poetry, you could draw, you could do drama, you could act, you know, philosophy, some of these kids excel when they get a chance to express themselves with the arts.
So now you're actually getting involved with kids these days.
Yes, yes.
Now you found out you were in your 30s?
I was 35 years old when I found out that I was adopted and didn't know my whole life.
That's amazing. So
it was the craziest thing that ever happened to me.
So how did you deal with that?
Jack Daniels and Jim Beam became my best friend.
Yeah.
Like for 24/7, and everybody was screaming at me, D, you're killing yourself. I mean, even before that, we was touring the world. It was Run D and Jam Master Jay. We wasn't on MTV. We wasn't on radio here. But somebody called them and said, y'all want to go to Europe and Asia and make a lot of money? Okay, but I would come off stage every night. 70,000, 100,000. One time we got 150 grand. We our last record was out, you know, 10 years ago. But I would go back to my hotel room and I would lay there every night depressed. There was this big hole in me. That depression, that void got so uncomfortable in me that I wanted to commit suicide. And I just said this. I was like, I knew I wasn't gonna do it, but I said, for me thinking like that, something's wrong. So I said, just in case I do die tomorrow, I want to write a book. Then I got to the point where I was born May 31st, 1964. Now, just for the reader, I was like, okay, my birthday is May 31st, 1964. But just for the reader, I need a couple of more details about the day I was born. So I call my mother up. Now, I'm at this point, I'm an alcoholic, suicidal, metaphysical, spiritual wreck with a hole and a void of depression in me. I go, hey, mom, how you doing? Hey, son, how you doing? You're getting too skinny. I'm like, no, mom, I work out now. You need to eat more. You know all the things all mothers right. do. I say, mom, I'm writing this book. I just want to know three things about the day I was born. How much did I weigh? What time I was born? What hospital? So she tells me those three things. All right, love you, hang up the phone. I'm typing away, getting the, you know, information ready to give to the guy that's helping me write the book. The hour goes by. The phone rings. I pick up the phone. It's my mother and my father. They go, hi, son. Hey, dad. Hey, son, we have something else to tell you. Well, okay, shoot. This is at age 35 at one of the worst points of my life. Well, you was a month old when we brought you home and you're adopted. Bye, we love you. That's how I found out. And right then and there, I really said, I want to kill myself now. It's over.
Really? Just like,
but you know,
you were adopted. We love you. Goodbye.
Yeah. I mean, I know what happened. She hung up the phone and said, bye, Fred. He's asking questions now. Now, the bad thing, people always say, D, why didn't they tell you earlier? They didn't want to hurt me, but they hurt me by not telling me. But the hurt went away when I realized they didn't tell me because they loved me.
So how do you, I mean, what kind of work are you doing now as a result of this kind of bolt out of the blue in your own life?
Well, I put my story out there so I can go and talk to the kids who feel what I felt at age 35. If I felt like that at age 35, imagine what the little kids feel. And this is my message to them. Regardless of your situation does not define who you are. That may be your situation. You may be homeless. You may be a foster kid. Your father may be in jail. Your mother may be on drugs or whatever. But that does not define who you, because I was one of you. I had no idea this little foster kid who fortunately got adopted would grow up to change hip-hop and make records with Aerosmith. So their purpose and destiny is part of their story is part of who you are, whether it's unfortunate or not, but you are the greatest thing to happen to this universe, because if it wasn't meant for you to be here to do something great, If what happened to me didn't happen, you would not be hearing this. They go, wow.
Well, we have been speaking with Daryl McDaniels, DMC from Run DMC, and his new DMC imprint, Daryl Makes Comics, begins with a graphic novel. The series continues after that on the DMC imprint, Daryl Makes Comics. Daryl, it has been a real pleasure having you with us on Soundcheck. Thank you so much.
Soundcheck, this was like the dopest interview ever.
And you mean that in a good way.
I really mean that, yeah. Top three.
Daryl DMC McDaniels with us on Soundcheck. As it turns out, there's lots more from Daryl McDaniels, a.k.a. DMC, and you can find it on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, more music from the Austin, Texas band White Denim. They'll play some more for us in the studio. We'll get to talk with them a bit as well. That's next on Soundcheck. So it's up. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band White Denim is here with us in the studio today, as you heard earlier in the show, all the way from Austin, Texas. They've got a new album coming out later this month called Corsicana Lemonade, and it's the follow-up to an acclaimed record called Simply D that the band did in 2011. Now, we like White Denim around the Soundcheck office, so when we saw they would be back in town for CMJ this week, we pressed them into service. And here they are, playing another song from the forthcoming record. This is called Pretty Green. It's White Denim, live on Soundcheck.
Hurried up for waiting, more times than I care to say, but it's
That is the band White Denim, live in our soundcheck studio here in New York, the band out of Austin, Texas, playing as part of the CMJ Festival this week here in New York. They're here with us on soundcheck today, and by they, I mean James Petralli, who sings and plays guitar, Austin Jenkins, who also plays guitar, Steve Terabecki on bass, and Josh Block on drums. Good to have you guys here with us once again.
Thanks for having us.
So, you know, there's constantly people coming and going here in the studios and the hallways and stuff. And when you guys were loading in today, you missed by about 30 seconds the English singer and producer Thomas Dolby, the guy who did She Blinded Me with Science and Hyperactive and so many other hits in the 80s. And when we told you guys that, you had a very strange response, which was,
We're kind of, it seems like we've always been a couple of steps behind Thomas Dolby on the road.
Really?
Yeah, there have been a few occasions. The one that kind of stands out to us most is our first South by Southwest. We did one of those hotel lobby kind of shows, and we followed Thomas Dolby. And before we went on, I think, we were eating Frito Pies or something like that. And,
of course and, you were.
what was he eating, Steve?
He was eating, a submarine sandwich, yeah.
So he was eating fresh?
Yeah.
He was eating, the man who wrote One of Our Submarines was eating a submarine sandwich.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's something vaguely unappealing about that, the way I just put it. So now, you guys are an Austin band. I mean, you come here to New York for CMJ, that's one thing. What is it like to be a part of South by Southwest there in your hometown? I mean, Steve, it seems like a lot of Austin bands try to get out of Dodge when South by is in town.
Did we try to do that last South by Southwest, or we still didn't get to do that?
I can't remember. It seems like we've played every single one of them since we started this band.
Yeah.
We didn't play last year, actually. We sat it out, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the last time you guys were here would have been about 5 years ago, and there were just three of you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've added Austin on guitar. How did that change the sound of the band then, and how has it sort of affected the sound of the band on the new record?
When Austin came on, we had kind of we had a lot of ideas for the D record.
Right.
He was really kind of helping us to bring that record to the stage.
Does that mean that you had written guitar parts harder than you could actually play? Is that what you're trying to say?
I mean, partially. I definitely couldn't play any of them and sing them at the same time.
Yeah.
Basically, for me to be able to sing, we definitely needed somebody. And Austin learned the tunes in, I don't know, 24 hours or something like that.
Yeah. I
think
D,
it was
yeah.
like 30, 35 songs or something like that that he had ready in a couple of days. So, after that, you know, we decided that he was our guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And on this record, he's really kind of taken the lead on a lot of the guitar arrangements. So
does this record sound different from prior White Denim records?
It sounds different in a lot of ways, I think. It's really different for me, playing more of a supporting role on guitar. There are also a few of the tunes on this record are just fully collaborative. You know, we're sitting around a table like this and kind of deciding what we were going to do.
Right. And at one point you decided, hey, Corsicana Lemonade would be a good name for the record. How did that happen?
Man, we probably had 40 different names.
Yeah,
for this record, and just kind of batted them around for weeks, I think, and then.
Yeah. But of course, Corsicana Lemonade is also the name of one of the songs. So
yeah, right.
There's got to be a meaning to that,
you know,
collection of syllables.
It's it was kind of an easy way out kind of thing. It was interesting. It kind of had a dual purpose. You know, we said, should we do this self-titled thing? You know, this is part of the collaborative thing when we all get together, and it takes just forever to decide on something. But I think we had E was a possible title, V was a possible title, Poco Rio. We had all kinds of different things, and I think the thing that we all kind of responded to the most was having a title track, and that's one of those tunes that, I mean, it's basically like a trip around Texas. It's something that I think that all of us are are interested in, and it kind of represented the record.
It could have been Texas music.
Yeah.
And here I was thinking, you know, the island of Corsica in the Mediterranean,
yeah.
Some kind of lemonade that they make only on that island.
No, Corsicana is a much, much less interesting place. It's outside of Waxahachie, which is...
Sorry, Corsicana residents.
Well, actually, I was just reading a Texas magazine where they had some ads about some kind of like railroad museum that they just opened up. So check that out if you're in Corsicana. Yeah.
All right. You want to play the song for us?
Sure.
All right. We're speaking with the members of White Denim. They're playing here in New York as part of CMJ, the annual CMJ Festival, and playing for us here in our Soundcheck studio today. The title track of their latest album, which comes out on October 29th, is this one, Corsicana Lemonade. It's White Denim. Live on Soundcheck. That's the band White Denim here in the Soundcheck studio with Corsicana Lemonade. It's the title track from their new album coming out on October 29th. James Petralli on voice and guitar, Austin Jenkins guitar, Steve Tarabecki on bass, Josh Block behind our drum kit here. The band is White Denim, and guys, it's been a while since you were last here. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Tomorrow on the show, Duke Ellington is one of the towering figures of 20th century American music, but there's more to his story than familiar songs like Take the A Train. Terry Teachout joins us to talk about his comprehensive new biography of Duke Ellington. And a visit from a contemporary composer, guitarist Bryce Dessner from the rock band The National. He's written some new string quartets for the renowned Kronos Quartet, and he'll share them with us. And we'll have some live music from the indie band Speedy Ortiz. That's going to do it for today's show. If you like our theme song, don't tell us, tell Marco Benevento. He's the guy who actually wrote it. Find out more about Marco on soundcheck.org. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast. It'll just make you feel good. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff with Isaac Davey Aronson and Amy Pearl, and our intern Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.